I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, flying high, Turkey's leader meets President Trump at the White House, why they are discussing fighter jets. Closing arguments. Lawmakers are making little progress to avoid a government shutdown next week. We're on Capitol Hill. Planned Parenthood pause, an update on a pro-life story in Wisconsin. Plus, a brush with greatness. Learn more about the restoration projects for artwork at the Vatican Museum. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us. Our top story tonight. President Donald Trump meets with President Erdogan of Turkey at the White House, giving him a warm welcome. President Trump says the two men have been friends for a long time, adding that Erdogan is a highly respected man who has built a tremendous military using a lot of American equipment. At today's meeting, a very big decision on the table coming at a very uncertain time in the world. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
Veronica, the U.S. has had a hold on selling F-35 fighter jets to Turkey. Turkey, of course, wants that hold lifted. And when President Trump and Turkey's president met today, I shouted my question.
President Trump, sir. President Trump, will you allow Turkey to buy F-35, sir?
We'll find out.
Earlier concerns over national security banned F-35 sales to the NATO ally. After their initial greeting outside, moments later in the Oval Office, the two leaders sat before reporters.
But I know he wants the F-35, and he's wanted that, and we're talking about that very seriously. And the F-16, we're in great shape.
Also complicating matters, President Trump concerned with Turkey's continued economic relationship with Russia. Since 2023, purchasing more than $90 billion in Russian oil, coal, and natural gas.
I'd like to have him stop buying any oil from Russia while Russia continues his rampage against Ukraine.
President Trump also met President Erdogan earlier this week at the United Nations to discuss Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza.
We had a very good meeting with the representatives of the most powerful countries in the Middle East, and I think we're going to be close to a deal.
But President Trump says he still has to meet with Israel. Erdogan has been sharply critical of Israel's handling of the war, alleging its forces have committed genocide, an allegation rebutted by Israel and the United States. In his Tuesday address at the UN, Erdogan laid into Israel over its recent strike in Qatar.
The attack on Qatar has also shown that the Israeli leadership is now completely out of control.
Today, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, spoke over video to world leaders after the United States revoked his visa. He says his people reject the 2023 Hamas attack on Israel and pledged that Hamas would have no role in governing Gaza after the war ends. And with the president of Turkey at his side, President Trump blamed the radical left for causing recent violence in America.
And it's going to get worse, and ultimately it's going to go back on them. I mean, bad things happen when they play these games. And I'll give you a little clue. The right is a lot tougher than the left. But the right's not doing this. They're not doing it. And they better not get them energized, because it won't be good for the left. And I don't want to see that happen either.
Now, over the years, U.S. officials have cited concerns about Turkey's human rights record under Erdogan. And separately today, President Trump was scheduled to meet with Pakistan's prime minister. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Now we'd like to bring on Gaith Almari, senior fellow at the Washington Institute. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, President Trump pressed President Erdogan to stop buying Russian oil. How does this pressure fit in with broader U.S. efforts to isolate Moscow? And what leverage does Washington have on this issue?
I mean, let's start with the leverage. The U.S. has a lot of leverage. At the end of the day, Turkey needs this relationship with the United States. So far, frankly, President Erdogan has been trying to play both sides. We have to be very clear about you choose us or the Russians. By the way, we talked about the F-35s. The reason why they're delayed is because, or why the deal has been stopped, because Turkey bought Russian air defense systems, the S-400s, the most advanced Russian defense system. So I think in many ways so far, President Erdogan has tried to get the best of both worlds. And I suspect what he's going to hear today from President Trump, or what he heard today from President Trump, is you have to choose us or them.
Now, during the meeting, President Trump was asked about Gaza and freeing the remaining hostages. Take a listen.
We want to get Gaza over with. I had a great meeting with the leaders of that area, of that region. I think we're close to getting some kind of a deal done. Yeah, we want to get the hostages back. I have to get the hostages back.
How close do you think the Trump administration is to a deal, and what influence might Turkey have as a regional mediator?
I'm not going to guess how close we are. We were unfortunately optimistic many times in the past. I don't know. But what I do know is that the administration is really ramping up the efforts. I know that they when they met with the Arab and Muslim leaders, when the president met with them in New York, he presented not only a plan to end the war, but a plan for the day after, something that those Arab leaders have been wanting in the past. The problem is, frankly, the Israelis are not particularly right now forthcoming, nor is Hamas. And this is where Turkey comes in. I do believe Turkey has a lot of leverage on Hamas. Turkey actually hosts Hamas. By the way, Turkey, you know, in the report you said that Turkey was critical of Israel. Every country in the region, Arab countries and Muslim countries, are. Where Turkey stands unique is that they support Hamas. And I think we should push them, first of all, to reduce the support, but also this gives Turkey a lot of leverage. If Turkey and Qatar, the two Hamas backers, go to Hamas and say, either accept the deal or you're going to be cut off, I believe Hamas will have no option. So again, Turkey has a role to play, and we should press Turkey whether or not it wants to play the role or wants to kind of play both sides.
Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suggested the idea of annexing parts of the West Bank in retaliation for Western countries recognizing a Palestinian state. Middle Eastern leaders have strongly rebuked the idea, and reports say President Trump is also against it. Could annexation stir Arabic countries into action?
Certainly would stir Arab countries to cut their relations with Israel. A few weeks ago, an official from the United Arab Emirates said this very clearly. Annexation means ending the Abraham Accords. Now, this is key for a number of reasons. First of all, the United Arab Emirates is Israel's closest ally in the Arab world. When they say it publicly, it tells you how frustrated they are. But maybe more importantly, the Abraham Accords is one of the President Trump's key achievements in his first term. And indeed, in the second term, he has been very clear that he wants to expand it by adding Saudi Arabia, etc. The president heard very clearly from Arab leaders, annexation would mean that any normalization with Israel is off the table. I believe this is what got the president to act. The president really wants to create integration in the region. Annexation would go at cross purposes with this American objective.
Gaith Almari, senior fellow at the Washington Institute, thank you.
Thank you.
Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy is sentenced to 5 years in prison for criminal conspiracy. Earlier today, the court found him guilty of attempting to finance his 2007 campaign with funds from Libya. The 70-year-old says the ruling is an injustice and plans to appeal. The court says the start date for his imprisonment is yet to be announced. He is the first former president of modern France to be sentenced to time behind bars. On Capitol Hill, the blame game and finger-pointing is only getting worse. U.S. lawmakers are out of town. They still face an immediate government funding deadline. If Congress doesn't act before Wednesday, October 1st, federal offices will close. Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales joins us with the latest. Eric.
Good evening, Veronica. The government is barreling toward a shutdown on Wednesday amid a standoff on Capitol Hill, and the Trump administration is already signaling that a shutdown would mean mass firings of federal workers. Both sides continue to blame each other. Democrats' red line, restoring billions of dollars in what they say were health care cuts as a result of the passing of the GOP-backed One Big Beautiful Bill.
Any agreement related to protecting the health care of the American people has to be ironclad and in legislation.
Democratic leadership say adding billions in health care, including coverage for undocumented immigrants, is a must.
And the Democrats' requests are completely unhinged and unreasonable and unserious. And if they want to have a serious conversation, I think that, you know, I'm sure the president would be happy to do that.
Now more turmoil. The White House Budget Office is threatening mass firings if a government shutdown happens. A memo from the Office of Management and Budget says in part, quote, programs that did not benefit from an infusion of mandatory appropriations will bear the brunt of a shutdown, and we must continue our planning efforts in the event Democrats decide to shut down the government. It does exempt safety net programs like the VA, military and law enforcement preparedness. Democrats call the memo an intimidation tactic intended to bully them into accepting the House-passed clean CR.
There is not one legitimate reason that Democrats should not support a continuing resolution. They have voted for it every time when Joe Biden and Barack Obama were president. The only reason I could think of is they just don't want to support a continuing resolution with Donald Trump as president.
So how many federal workers could be laid off? The OMB has not yet released that number, but the longest shutdown took place in 2018 during the first Trump administration, and it lasted 35 days. 380,000 workers were furloughed, and 420,000 were deemed essential. They were required to work without pay. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
For more, we turn to Preston Brashears, the research fellow for tax policy at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica.
What are the main issues holding up an agreement in Congress, and how close are lawmakers to reaching a last-minute deal to avoid a shutdown?
Well, the House of Representatives, the GOP House of Representatives, has already passed the clean CR. The clean CR would basically just take the funding levels from the Biden administration that have been going on for nearly a year and a half at this point, and continue those on forward. That's what passed out of the House of Representatives. The Democrats have objected to that. They have nearly $1.5 trillion of asks that they want to add on to this. That includes, as you mentioned, some of the things that were passed in the One Big Beautiful Bill. They want to revoke some of those, take some of those things back. They want to add back things like NPR spending. They want to extend out some Obamacare subsidies for Americans making six figures. And this comes out to $1.5 trillion of additional spending, which is really unprecedented for holding out on a CR.
Now, of course, Democrats and Republicans seem very far apart on these issues, but sometimes they can get it together in enough time. But if not, which party or leaders are likely to take most of the political blame if a shutdown occurs?
I mean, the media will perhaps try to spin it as this being something on President Trump, but the reality of the situation is a clean CR is just keeping the status quo as is, and that's what the Republican House has already passed. I think the idea of adding $1.5 trillion of additional spending, to see that as a reasonable ask when you don't hold the House, you don't hold the Senate, you don't hold the White House, you kind of have to look at who has the cards in this situation, who holds. And in previous situations where Republicans have been pushing to have to reduce government spending, the threat of a government shutdown for a party that is trying to reduce government spending seems completely different than a party that's pushing to increase government spending and is now willing to shut down the government over it.
Now, for Americans watching, if there is a shutdown, what specific programs or services would be disrupted?
Yeah, and so the idea that it's a government shutdown, it's probably a little bit of a misnomer. It wouldn't be the entire government shutting down. About 27% of the federal government would be affected by the annual appropriations. So that's what we're talking about here. It's just things like Social Security and Medicare, those would continue to be funded. Any sort of programs where you're talking about the public safety, the military, these sorts of things will continue on. There may be some workers that would be asked to work temporarily without pay. They would generally be recouped on any pay that they missed during that period when the government reopens.
Preston Brashears, thank you so much.
Thanks, Veronica.
In Wisconsin, Planned Parenthood has paused abortion services. The nation's largest abortion business cites a lack of funding amid Medicare cuts from the Big Beautiful Bill passed in July. In the Badger State, abortion is legal up to 20 weeks. Federal agencies launch a review of the abortion drug mifepristone. The probe is being done by the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Health. Mifepristone is one of the drugs widely used in medication abortions. A report from the Ethics and Public Policy Center says the drug is unsafe, risky, and reverses and requires more oversight. Officials at Georgetown University are investigating posters left on campus that appear to be a call for violence. A colleague of the late Charlie Kirk posted a picture on social media yesterday of the campus flyers. The phrase is the same slogan allegedly written by the main suspect in Kirk's murder. School officials say they removed the posters and are investigating who left them. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly, including behind the scenes. EWTN gets an up-close look at the Vatican's Art Restoration Lab, the big project they have in store. And Pope Leo's message of appreciation for 300 priests for their unusual line of work. Today, the church mourns the loss of a Romanian cardinal who lived an extraordinary life. Cardinal Lucian Mureșan passed away today at 94. He was a prelate of the Roman Greek Catholic Church. Under the communist regime, he was forced to attend trade school for carpentry, but eventually entered the seminary. In his fourth year of study, he was expelled by the regime and forced to work in a rock quarry. However, despite all the challenges, he was ordained in 1964 and exercised his ministry in total secrecy. He was named bishop after the fall of communism in 1994, then became cardinal in 2012. Pope Leo sends a message of appreciation to a recent international gathering of exorcists. At the global gathering near Rome, held every 2 years, the Holy Father said their work is a ministry of liberation and consolation. He also says to support those possessed by the evil one with prayer and to ask for help from Christ, because then the Lord may grant victory. The gathering featured around 300 exorcist priests. It's one of the most revered works in Catholic history, and soon maintenance will begin on the Last Judgment painted by Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. The Vatican's Art Restoration Laboratory offered EWTN a behind-the-scenes look at their work and mission, which they say goes beyond material restoration. EWTN News Vatican correspondent Valentina Di Donato reports.
Today, after more than 30 years, we return to the final judgment for maintenance work. Not a restoration. It's an extraordinary maintenance work that we do every year in the Sistine Chapel.
EWTN got a behind-the-scenes look at Italy's oldest painting restoration lab. Though its main task is to restore delicate pieces of art, statues, and woodworking, its mission goes beyond the work itself. Here, there is a deeper meaning and purpose.
I always say that we take care of the physical restoration of the work, but at the Vatican, what's very important and unique is the restoration of the immaterial value of the work, the significance, the context in which the artist wanted to express through his technique and style.
Paolo Violini is the new head of the Restoration Laboratory for Paintings and Wooden Material at the Vatican Museums. He first entered in 1988, accidentally, or perhaps by design.
I was catapulted directly onto the scaffolding of the Sistine Chapel. In those years, work was being concluded on the vault. At the time, I was a young guy, about 30 years old, and I helped the older, more expert restorers to work on those aspects. I remained on the scaffolding of the Sistine Chapel for the entire time of the restoration of the Final Judgment.
Rimasto sul ponteggio della Cappella Sistina per tutto il tempo del restauro del giudizio.
And now the annual maintenance of the Sistine Chapel will begin soon, right after Pope Leo XIV baptizes newborns on the feast of the Baptism of the Lord in January. It's a rite that takes place at the baptismal font inside the Sistine Chapel, which represents the tree of life that holds the rising sun in its branches. The lab also breathes life back into relics and works that seem to be at their end, like this crucifix from the Abbey of Sant'Eutizio in central Italy. In 2016, an earthquake hit the region, devastating much of the peninsula. Historic churches and buildings destroyed, and this crucifix, made in 1472, shattered into pieces.
Noi abbiamo restaurato una croce, un crocifisso.
We restored a wooden cross that was reduced to 49 pieces, all reconstructed together again after 1 year, and then we were able to bring it back to the Umbrian church, a cross that was nearly totally destroyed. It gave great satisfaction, even the moment it was initially recovered. Recovering those fragments within the rubble and then putting them together again, really, it's seeing a piece reborn in the most literally sense.
Here, even when shattered into pieces, there is always a fragment of hope. In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Faces of Hope. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia's initiative features inspiring stories of everyday Catholics. We speak to one of the faces of hope. The Archdiocese of Philadelphia begins an initiative highlighting the importance of everyday Catholics in the Church's mission. Faces of Hope examines the stories of the faithful who make the Church a force for good in the Philadelphia area. This includes the story of Nina Marie Corona, a successful business owner who leaned heavily on her faith when addiction crept into her family. That inspiration led to a program that's being shown in colleges and parishes in the United States and beyond. EWTN's Eric Rosales recently sat down with Nina Marie to learn more.
And joining us now is Nina Marie Corona. Nina, great to be with you. First of all, tell us more about your story and how you dealt with the serious issue of addiction in your family and you turned to your Catholic faith.
I did. At the time, my story started years ago now, but at the time, I was pursuing theology, and a loved one became addicted to prescription medications, and it escalated to very serious addiction, and it set me on a journey, a faith journey. Of course, I had already been on a faith journey, but it set me into, I think, a new understanding of my faith and understanding of addiction at the same time. And what emerged from that was a ministry. It was never expected. But along the journey, as I grew in understanding and I began to talk more and more with others about this topic, I realized that it was widespread. I didn't know that at the time. And that many, many people were suffering in silence, especially in the church, because addiction, of course, is, you know, there's a lot of stigma surrounding it. And I would say even more so within the church. And I believe that's due to a lack of understanding about the nature of addiction. And so as I learned more and more about addiction, I ended up creating a program when I was in graduate school called We Thirst Christian Reflections on Addiction. And like I said, it evolved into a ministry to bring understanding, healing, and hope, exactly. Especially into the church.
Yeah. Talk to us about how you came up specifically with that name.
Well, We Thirst stands for the underlying thirst that we all have that is for God, of course, but that we don't necessarily recognize as being a thirst for God. And so at some point in the series, when I talk about the spiritual nature of addiction, I explain how there are many ways that people try to satisfy that thirst, not recognizing that it is a thirst for God. And of course, one of those ways is substances.
Tell us a little bit more about the Archdiocese of Philadelphia's initiative, Faces of Hope. And, you know, you're now part of this, correct?
Yes. Well, yeah, I was humbled to be one of the Faces of Hope. And the Archdiocese of Philadelphia really has been at the forefront of all of this. They were one of the first dioceses to really embrace this program. And they understood its need and the role that the church can play in aiding people, in providing hope and comfort and mercy. And they've just been extremely supportive. It was even presented for the Archdiocesan headquarters, for the staff and for the clergy, and at various churches throughout the Archdiocese over the years.
Nina Marie Corona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eric. Take care.
Take care.
God bless.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.